Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of Leading the Charge, Leadership Lessons from the Battlefield to the Boardroom. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. So, General Zinni, how do you balance the right mix of hard and soft power when confronted with the global challenges facing the nation today?
I don't think there's a sort of a percentage mix. I think each situation is differently. Some situations, the security or hard power requirement is minimal. Some cases, it's dominant and maybe has to have more investment, maybe certainly in the initial stages. But it's clear that hard and soft power, unlike the past, has to be married pre-conflict. You need to have an organization that's trained, equipped, plans for, understands how to have an integrated team approach on the battlefield. And you're beginning to see some elements of this, and again, led by the military. The U.S. Southern Command, Admiral Stavridis when he was down there, the Africa Command, you see their staffs that are more integrated. They don't just reflect military requirements. In some cases, you actually have, I know in the case of African Command, their deputy was a State Department former ambassador. And you're beginning to see that kind of integration. Again, there is no formula for the mix. It should be flexible. Maybe security plays a 10% role. Maybe it plays a 90% role. Maybe it goes from 90 to 10 in the course. I think clearly, again, it has to be integrated from the beginning. There's a degree of planning and preparation and pre-conflict integration that has to take place and understanding. We need to build better systems. I always used to argue that if I had a counterpart in State Department, if it was the regional assistant secretaries, we should be co-located. And that we should work together. Not that they come under military command, certainly wouldn't be in favor of that, but we should co-locate, we should co-plan, we should co-analyze our regions. Even the structure is wrong. The world as it's divided up in the world of State Department and the world of Department of Defense are different. Our regions are different. When I was a CENTCOM commander, I had to work with four assistant secretaries with overlapping or underlapping regions, and that's very confusing. And it could change policy. I mean, I had, largely the Middle East, but I didn't have Israel. That can drive a lot of policy decisions that affect the rest of the elements of power. But from my perspective, it did, but it was sort of external. It was in the area of interest, not really in the area of influence I had. And so that can be problematic in the way you deal with it. So we also ought to look at structuring. We ought to look at cooperation. We ought to look at more integration at the lowest levels. And again, planning is critical. The military are crazy planners. We plan everything as much as we can in detail. I got to say, and I guess others can argue with it, I don't see the same level at the other agencies and departments.
So the U.S. can't do everything. And in that mind, I'd like to get your insights into how you choose priorities to act and what are the limits of power, influence, and leadership for the U.S.?
Well, I think we're learning that we have greater limitations now. We've come from a sort of a heady time when we emerged from World War II as the most dominant power in the world and have learned now that maybe it's not so much that we have been on the decline, it's others that have been on the rise. I don't believe it's a zero-sum game. That's good news in many ways. There's more partners out there. There's more burden sharing. So I think that what the U.S. has to understand is it's not so much what you can do yourself, but it's what you can create in terms of international and regional cooperation to share the burden and the work together. Now we always talk about American leadership. Sometimes it's American leadership, sometimes it's not. Look at East Timor, the Australians led, and we support it. I think we're trying to do that in Libya in many ways, or let NATO lead. I think we need to do far greater work in building international and regional cooperation and entities that could deal with this. When I had part of Africa as part of Central Command, I always felt that we didn't pay enough attention. Here was a continent that really tried to organize itself regionally and sub-regionally. The African Union, ECOWAS, ECOMOG, SADC, the EAC. I mean, all these organizations that are created to try to deal with security issues, economic issues, political issues, they lacked resources, training, education, and experience in these areas. And I didn't see, again, the developed world helping them with this. Everybody waited until it was a complete disaster. The developed world threw boots on the ground to answer the problem, then regretted it and complained about it. When I saw these organizations saying, help us put it together, we need resources, we need the training, we need the education, the investment, but we want to handle our own problems. I think there needs to be more of that. I think we ought to reassess our relationships. I'm not so happy with the performance in NATO in Afghanistan or Libya. You know, it's 28 nations with maybe a handful that really, truly participate. It's become dysfunctional. And I know that's sort of something that people don't want to hear, but we need to reassess relationships like that, maybe build new coalitions. And we need to understand what they are. Are they political relationships? Are they military alliances? You know, what do they do? It's important for us to make sure they're viable for the 21st century and not relics of the Cold War or post-World War II era.
General Zinni, it's been 25 years since the Goldwater-Nichols Act reworked the command structure of the United States military. What do you like about the Goldwater-Nichols-Nunn-Cohen model, and what further enhancements are needed to meet the demands of the day? What more needs to be done?
I think the brilliance of Goldwater-Nichols is the fact that the integrating element was not set up as a separate bureaucracy. What I mean by that, you know, when I was a young major at our headquarters, I worked on Goldwater-Nichols, and I remember the only thing we cooperated with the other services was to kill Goldwater-Nichols. And as a young major, I couldn't quite understand why. And I remember my chief of service telling me, you know, the big fear was like all government solutions to integration problems, they're going to create what he called a class of mandarins, a separate, you know, look how the intelligence community created the DNI's office. Look how Homeland Security was created. Most of the times when reform is needed and integration is the problem, as we saw in the intelligence problems post 9/11 and Homeland Security, the answer is to integration is create another structure, add more bureaucracy, add more tiers, and that becomes dysfunctional in the end. What Goldwater-Nichols said to the services, we're not going to create a separate – the joint structure will be manned from the services. You will man it, and you will man it with people that won't come from the outside but from the inside. You will serve tours in the joint world. We demand quality. It's going to be a requirement for promotion. You will have components represent you in each of the joint structures, senior componency. So by you manning the organization and those people returning to your service, by you having senior level components that are the substantive elements of it, you have representation, you have a voice, and you have a say in the decision making. And so what happens is the leery services that once had to do this suddenly realize, well, look, you know, the joint command, who is CENTCOM, for example? Well, the commander's a Marine, you know, and may return or go into something else, but came from the Marine Corps. The deputy is from the Army, you know, the director of operations is from the Air Force or whatever, and it maneuvers around. You get different services. There is a component. There is a senior general or flag officer over a staff structure that represents component interests. Those component interests, meaning service interests, are represented in the command at a very senior level. How you employ those forces, how you best present their capabilities, how you work toward helping the commander integrate them are all coming. So it was built from whole cloth. And so what I think happened, I watched this from the mid-80s, Goldwater-Nichols was passed, so I left the service in 2000. I saw us go through three phases. I would describe the first phase as deconfliction. All right, we got to do this. It's law. Let's stay out of each other's way. Let's find a way to deconflict on the battlefield or whatever we do. We'll agree to disagree in places. We'll carve our own path, and you know, but we'll sort of reluctantly and begrudgingly look at each other, and so we went through the deconfliction phase, and it was a very defensive era. I mean, Marines worried about somebody stealing their air, and you know, we went through all sorts of issues. Each service becoming very parochial and very concerned, very paranoid to a large extent. All of a sudden, as we began to work through this, we found, you know, these are Americans over there, and we all are trying to do the same thing. We have our service issues, but we're beginning to find some of the service issues we thought were issues you could actually resolve. So we moved into the second phase, which I think really began maybe in the early 90s, which I would call the coordination phase. We actually found, let's not just deconflict. We could actually work together. And the synergy, you know, that came from that, the efficiencies and effectiveness could be great. And then I think by the time I left, I saw true integration. And where I think I saw true integration is when we were making decisions in the joint world, we didn't look at uniforms anymore. We didn't think in terms of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Special Operations. We thought we were thinking in terms of capabilities. Look, for this mission, this is the capability I need. You looked at options, you know, who could provide it. You were willing to take those options if they were service options and actually integrate them further. So I think we've arrived at true integration. I think it's a good model, again, for the other agencies of government or the interagency process.
Well, over the past decade or more, we've seen those joint forces increasingly used to perform humanitarian, peacekeeping, and disaster relief operations. From your perspective, is the military well-structured now and equipped for such operations, or what could be done to improve our capabilities there?
No, in terms of training and equipping and organizing, it's a zero-sum game. I mean, you can't optimize for everything. We can't afford it, first of all. I mean, I remember when the discussion was maybe in the early 80s or early 90s, well, maybe we should have a bifurcated military, one that sort of handles these kinds of missions, another that's more tuned for the conventional or larger scale operations. We can't afford it. I think what we have to do, it's always a question of optimizing or hedging. You know, where do you take risks? Obviously, going to try to take fewer risks at a level that presents a more existential threat to you. So, you know, you've got to leverage the technology, invest in modernization in areas where you don't want to lose an edge, or you want to maintain a significant edge, where if you don't, it could become significant and a potential threat can create a greater capability that makes it more dangerous to miscalculate or misadventure into something disastrous. At this level that we're talking about here, these kinds of missions are where we're going to hedge. We should be honest about that. So you may say, I can't afford maybe a lot of training in that, you know, but I can invest maybe more in education and understanding, which is a little less resource intensive. We did this when I was a 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. We ran a series of, we called them exercises, but they were really seminars and discussions called Emerald Express. We had a number of commitments and missions that would drive us toward peacekeeping, humanitarian, and other missions specifically designated for us by some of the combatant commanders. And I didn't need to put a Marine team out there on an exercise on a reverse osmosis water purification unit, because he's going to do the same thing, whether it's conventional warfare or low-intensity warfare or whatever we call it now. So I didn't need him out there to do it. Basically, these kinds of missions need the education of senior leaders, enlisted and officer, better understanding. I thought the training was more efficient and effective to spend a week or two a year bringing in non-governmental organization people, State Department people, United Nations people, coalition partners from around the world that face these sorts of things in Africa and Central America and elsewhere, and to educate the leaders what had to be done. And so I think there are smarter ways you can minimize risk, you can hedge, and you can understand the resource impacts. And that's where I think you got to deal at this level primarily. I don't think you can afford two services. There just isn't enough time. You can't draw away from certain kinds of training and education and preparation and planning requirements because they deal with existential threats when these may not be, more often than not.
What does the future hold for advancing the use of smart power in the battle for peace? We will ask General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.